Jackson, W266, DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. In Chicago, a grand jury indicts 10 people charged in the death of a mentally ill man who suffocated while in law enforcement custody in Virginia. CBS's Matt Piper.
Justice for Ivo.
Justice for Ivo.
The family of Ivo Otieno, along with their attorney, with those calls following seven deputies from a Virginia sheriff's office being indicted on one count of second-degree murder each. Three hospital employees were also each indicted. He was being transported from a jail to a state-run psychiatric facility when he was eventually held down for 11 minutes, dying at the scene. His brother, Leon.
This is just the beginning. There's a long battle ahead for all of us. So let the conversation be about a reform on mental health awareness and how we deal with it.
Matt Piper, CBS News.
Workers in the Los Angeles Unified School District are on a three-day strike. On this first day, they were joined by teachers who also walked off in solidarity over stalled contract talks.
Without bus drivers, without cafeteria workers, without custodians, the classroom doesn't run.
Rebecca Anderson is a special education assistant. Her union says low wages are pushing workers into poverty. They're demanding a 30% raise.
We don't get a raise every year.
After 22 years, she now makes $25 an hour.
That's CBS's Carter Evans reporting. In California, at least one person has died in Northern California after wind toppled a tree in Portola Valley. There are downed trees and power lines across the Bay Area and Central Coast. CBS meteorologist David Parkinson.
You will see more power outages, more trees coming down, and more property damage over the next several hours. There's also another round of rain for Southern California coming up this evening into tonight, and things calm down on your Wednesday.
Former President Trump is waiting to see if he'll be indicted over the grand jury investigation in Manhattan involving alleged falsifying of business records to hide campaign finance violations tied to payments made to an adult film star. CBS's Robert Costa also reports.
As Trump deals with a possible indictment, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, moving closer to his own 2024 bid, said in a new interview that character matters, a remark seen by some Trump advisors as a not-so-veiled shot at Trump.
President Biden hosts a number of singers, authors, and humanitarians at the White House, handing out 23 National Medal of Arts and the National Humanities Medal. The group included Bruce Springsteen, Gladys Knight, and actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
To be honest with you, I think there's been a bit of a clerical error, so I would prefer for you not to delve too deep. I think I'm not necessarily supposed to be on this list, but delighted to be here nonetheless.
U.S. home sales surged in February as mortgage rates dipped. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual Insurance.
WAUK 540 AM. Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. One man is dead after a customer at a Middleton auto dealership shot an employee yesterday afternoon. Police say the Fitchburg woman was upset over a vehicle she'd bought. She's under arrest. Dan Kelly says his opponent talks too much about politics and that she can't be trusted to be fair ruling on issues like abortion.
I'm not a legislator because I don't talk about my politics. I understand what the court is supposed to do, and that's resolving legal questions.
He debated Janet Protasiewicz today in the only head-to-head debate in the Wisconsin Supreme Court general election. The whole debate tonight at 6 on many of these Civic Media radio stations. In sports, Badger men's basketball plays Oregon tonight in the NIT quarterfinals. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Don't you deserve a job you'd love? Civic Media is preserving hometown radio, broadcasting from main streets across Wisconsin, and we're hiring radio advertising sales professionals to join our rapidly growing network of local radio stations. If you have a connection to your community, prior sales experience, and want to earn an outstanding living where you and your hard work is appreciated, you should apply right now. Find more information on our website, civicmedia.us. Click on the Careers tab.
Max Inc. Radio presents Bob Blastica 2023. It's Max Inc.'s 27-year anniversary party, and you're invited. Bob Blastica at the Wisco on Willie Street. Saturday, April 15th, Max Inc. Radio's Jimmy K. Rocker and Terry Barr will broadcast live 6 to 9 p.m. Then live music from Eclipse record recording artist Carbellion. With special guest Milwaukee's Wizard Hammer. And Mad City's own hard rockers, Iron Claw. We are the Iron Claw. It's Bombblastica 2023, Saturday, April 15th at the Wisco in Madison. Sponsored by Rocker Vodka and Hotel K Pet City. Presented by Max Inc. Radio. We are local music.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com. A progressive voice from Beaver Dam to Kenosha. WAUK 540 AM, always streaming at
waukradio.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got an email from Bruce listening on KTNF in Minneapolis. He wrote, Rick, thanks for bringing up Debbie and Reagan's crimes. It's about time we hold people accountable. He said, I am curious, why do you think this information with Ben Barnes is coming out now? And that was one of the first questions I had. Is why now, after 43 years, why the cleansing of the soul? Why is this guy who was a powerful operative, why now? What is it, because Carter's about to pass? I don't know. But here to shed some light, share some thoughts, I've asked my good friend Greg Palace to come talk with us. Greg is known for his investigative reports at The Guardian and BBC Television. He is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Read his article, Reagan's Treason, Two Bushes, and a $23 million payoff at gregpalace.com. And download for free Palace's BBC film, Bush Family Fortunes. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Okay, glad to be with you again, Rick.
I got through it, all of it, word by word. But here's to answer Bruce's question. Why now? Why is it that this guy has chosen this moment in history, 43 years, mind you, this? Why now?
Okay, let's let in the people who've just joined us. What happened this week is that the New York Times ran an article, an interview with Ben Barnes, former lieutenant governor of Texas, who said, golly gee, I have something to confess. He's about 86. And he said, now that Jimmy Carter is dying, who's 98, I just want to tell him that, yes, we stole the election from him by he literally was involved in cutting a secret deal with the Iranians to hold those American hostages. Remember, there were 52 American hostages taken by the Iranians from our embassy. I believe two died, by the way.
Right.
And Reagan... secretly, Reagan's campaign secretly cut a deal with the Ayatollah Khomeini to hold those hostages for almost an extra year so that Reagan could win the presidency and then he would pay off the Iranians. And he did. It's called Iran-Contra. That is, so what happened was, is the Iranians agreed secretly with Reagan. And by the way, this is an act of treason. They agreed with Reagan to hold the hostages. The day Reagan took the oath of office, in fact, while he was taking the oath of office, because the Iranians didn't want to take any chances, they watched him put his hand on the Bible, and at that minute, literally, in 1981, January 20, they released the 50 hostages.
Yep.
And what did Reagan do in return? He gave them guns and ammunition secretly to the Ayatollah. That giving weapons to an enemy of America is also an act of treason. So Reagan committed a horrible act of treason, literally keeping Americans kidnapped and imprisoned so he could get elected president. And then he paid off the Ayatollah. And now it's coming. So now the question is, why is it coming out now? Why does this guy Ben Barnes? First of all, the story was originally reported fairly quickly in 80 by the great journalist Bob Perry. who was then fired for his.
No, I remember it. I was 13 at the time, and I remember. Yes. I remember the spectacle and the fact
it's
that
called the October Surprise.
Exactly, and they made such a big deal about the fact that the second he put his hand on the Bible, they basically loaded their pants. They were so afraid of what Reagan was going to do. They released everybody in a hurry. That was the message
yeah, right.
at the time.
So it was the big payoff. Now, why though did Barnes wait till now? The answer is, take a look at a payment he got for $23 million, because this is not the first time Barnes has pulled this stunt. As lieutenant governor, this is very, very important to understand his relationship with the Bushes. And keep in mind, part of the deal is that Bush Sr. is dead, because he also had the information that Bush Sr. was up to his knickers in Iran-Contra.
Sure.
Something that Bush Sr. ducked and weaved and tried to get out of. But that disqualified him for president as well. So Barnes not only covered up for Reagan, helped him get elected, covered up for Bush Sr., helped him get elected. But are you ready for this? This is the same guy, when I did my investigation for BBC, who arranged for George W. Bush, little George, to get into the Texas Air Guard in 1965, to get into the Texas Air Guard to avoid going to Vietnam. So in other words, George W. was a draft dodger. His daddy, Congressman Bush, made the call to Ben Barnes and got Barnes to get his little sonny boy into the Texas Air Guard. Now, you have to understand, when George Bush was allowed into the Air Guard, literally thousands of people were applying for those fighter pilot positions. Almost everyone who applied already knew how to fly a fighter jet, by right. the way. He was the first person ever to get the job without having any jet flying experience. And he got 25 out of 100, which meant 1 point above too dumb to fly. Also, when he applied, one thing I found out in my investigation, when I was sent there by BBC television and by the Guardian newspapers to Texas, I went to the Texas Air Guard and was able to get inside documents. I can't tell exactly how, but it was George W. Bush's personal application, and in it, he is the only member of the Air Guard, except for his best buddy, Salim bin Laden, who was his best buddy. Only he and bin Laden said they would not serve in Vietnam. They would not fly in Vietnam. Every other Air Guard pilot, by the way, agreed that they would still continue to fly missions in Vietnam, except for Bush and bin Laden. By the way, yes, that is Osama's brother, but please, I don't want to have 9/11 people say, yeah, that's an inside job. No. Salim bin Laden and Osama were estranged. Now, but I will say there was a problem there, because also we discovered with the BBC, because of the very close personal relationship between the Bushes and the bin Ladens, it made investigation of the bin Laden family very difficult. That doesn't mean 9/11 was an inside job. It just meant it was very hard right. to uncover facts beforehand. But I want you to know that this is the Ben Barnes who got George into the Air Guard, got him out of Vietnam. Now, why is that important to this story? It's not just a side little cutesy thing, because there's something very important there. It's $23 million. Ben Barnes basically had George W.'s political career in his pocket. He had Bush Sr.'s career in his pocket. He could release this information about the draft dodging and the October surprise and destroy both men like that. So what did he do? Well, Ben Barnes got kicked out as lieutenant governor in a scandal of his own. But then he landed a job with a company called GTEC as their lobbyist. GTEC was in hot water. This is where my investigations began for The Guardian and BBC, ironically, because I was investigating GTEC as the corrupt operator of the British lottery and the Texas lottery. That was their two big lotteries that they operated. They made billions. But they were removed. They were going to be – they'd been found – they'd been caught trying to corrupt politicians in Texas. So they were disqualified from running the lottery. The lottery was going to be given to another company when the newly elected governor of Texas – and by the way, you know how he got newly elected. Ann Richards, the Democratic governor, running against Bush – she was running for re-election against George W. It was a neck-and-neck race. She knew what Barnes had done. She begged Ben Barnes, please make it public, Bush's draft dodging. He refused. He refused. She lost by a squeaker to George W. Bush. And then when G-Tech, when his company is about to be disqualified from the Texas lottery.
He calls in Bush, the marker.
Bush and Barnes have a meeting. 2 days after the meeting, suddenly the lottery director is fired. The new lottery director comes in and cancels the new contract, gives the contract to Ben Barnes' company, and he gets a $23 million payday. So am I saying that in that meeting, Barnes said, hey, I've got the goods on you, buddy. I'm going to burn you and your daddy from hell to breakfast unless I get my $23 million. They just say, hey, long time no see. Remember the good old days when you were in the Texas Air Guard and daddy was involved in Iran-Contra? Oh, remember those good old days? Oh, by the way, my client has a little problem with a contract. Can you fix that? You can imagine how it goes. Come on. Yeah, we're all grown-ups here. So this guy cashed in on his omerta. Let's be very clear. By the way, he's never denied it to me. He denied it, he claims, in a lawsuit, but that testimony was sealed with a payment. So Ben Barnes, he's not the great hero that the New York Times plays him. Oh, finally, he's unburdening his soul. First of all, so why didn't he unburden it in 1980 and prevent Ronald Reagan from stealing the election? Why didn't he release it in the 1990s and shoot down war hero George W. Bush? Why didn't he release it in 2000 when Gore and Bush, when Gore supposedly lost the presidency by just 537 votes? Why didn't he release it then? By the way, he did admit to the fix, Ben Barnes, the Air Guard, getting George Bush into the Air Guard, but he did that in 2004 after Bush had already been elected. He was feeling very guilty. He was leaned on by a group of veterans who had heard what had happened and read my investigation, and they leaned on him, and he felt so terrible that he agreed to admit to getting George, little Georgie, into the Air Guard and out of Vietnam.
Yeah.
So it's all about the money. So that's what you have to understand. And, you know, he had to wait for George Sr. to die. And I guess he waited, who knows what his condition is. But, you know, I understand he's actually a religious man.
Of course they are.
He's worried about his soul.
They do all of these things in the name of religion because they're special. If you've ever read Jeff Charlotte's book about C Street, you know that they're special. No matter how bad they screw things up, they're the chosen ones. So, of course, they're special. But, you know, I look at this, and I read the article, and I'm going, this guy's a really powerful guy, was a powerful guy then. They made him out to be a dupe. I didn't know why I was there.
On.
You know, unwittingly, I think, was one of the words that was thrown out.
Yes,
exactly,
unwittingly.
Why he was there.
Unwittingly. Okay, that's the New York Times headline writer, that he was unwittingly involved in Iran in the secret deal to keep Americans hostage. What do you mean unwitting? First of all, this guy is one of the sharpest politicians in America. He was lieutenant governor of Texas. And in Texas, by the way, that position is equal in power to the governor. He was under John Connally, switched from Democratic to Republican. By the way, Barnes is a Democrat. Because he never switched with Connally. He goes with the governor of Texas. He's lieutenant governor. They both left office, and they're off in the Middle East. For what? And he seems to know all about the phone calls to the future CIA director, Casey, who was campaign manager for Ronald Reagan, who kept saying, have they agreed to hold the hostages? Have they agreed to hold the hostages? So what does he mean, since he heard that phrase, what did he mean that he didn't know why he was there? What did he think he was there for? He knew exactly what he was there for, to collect his $23
million. Yeah, no, so
he knew that he had gold in his pockets.
I go, Greg, you know, I had always, and look, this again, I was 13 at the time, and even I knew at the time that there was shenanigans going on because I had heard the story then.
Yes.
I always thought it was H.W. Bush who was behind all this. I never thought Reagan was all that bright. But H.W., former head of the CIA, all of these connections, this now really kind of puts this all in perspective a little bit better, because now we know, instead of just speculating. Any of this going to fall back on the HW legacy then?
I hope so. I mean, one of the things that's sick about this is, once again, it's pretty clear if you're involved with Ben Barnes. Remember, Herbert Walker Bush was congressman. He was dealt with Barnes. He got Barnes to get his son into Vietnam. You think if they weren't talking about the Iran-Contra business, it's clear Bush Sr. was up to his knickers in it. Plus, yeah. Casey, who was running Ronald Reagan's campaign, was about to become CIA director. That is taking, you know, taking the job that Herbert Walker Bush had. Come on. So it's clear that Bush Sr. was up to his knickers in this. And don't forget, the reason why they're saying it's unwitting, I'm sure a deal was cut about what they could say about him in advance. Because let's face it, what this guy committed, he was involved in treason. He's involved in a payoff. He was involved in the fix on the air guard. And by the way, that may be also a crime. But for sure, he was involved in this treasonous activity. And treason it is. By the way, when just so you know, this is the second October surprise. The first one was very, very similar. That's where they got the idea when Bush was CIA director, which was Nixon. I mean, before Bush became CIA director under Nixon, when Nixon was running for president against Hubert Humphrey, there was a peace agreement, a tentative peace agreement reached with the Vietnamese government of Ho Chi Minh, and the war in Vietnam was about to end. And then Nixon himself got involved through Chiang Kai-shek, getting to the South Vietnamese puppet regime that we had, which had to sign off on any deal and say, oh, don't sign any of these deals because we'll get you a better deal once Nixon is president. So literally, that was the same thing. Lyndon Johnson called up Senator Everett Dirksen, who was then had Mitch McConnell's job as head of the Senate, the Republican leader of the Senate. And he told Dirksen, he said, you know, we literally have recordings of Nixon and Nixon's buddies speaking to the South Vietnamese government, saying, don't sign the peace agreement, and also trying to tell the North Vietnamese, the Ho Chi Minh, don't sign the peace agreement. You'll get a better deal, too, if we come in. So the South Vietnamese refused to sign the deal. The war continued. Nixon was elected. 1 million Vietnamese died. Another 22,000 Americans died under Nixon's watch while he dragged it on. So this October surprise game was not invented by Reagan and Bush Sr. Well, it might have been Bush Sr. might have been involved in the first one. We don't know yet. We still have to, you know, I think that those records are going to start opening up. But because where else did they get this idea?
No. So let me last question I've got for you on this then. How does this help us moving forward? Because, you know, I've said, you know, for years, we never hold any of these criminals accountable. Never. These presidents do these things and it's always they're out of office. Let sleeping dogs lie. We don't do these. You know, they only do this going after political opponents and third world countries. You got, you know, McCarthy right now about Trump saying, you know, we don't go after our political opponents, you know, all that stuff. How does this help us now?
Well, I don't believe in letting sleeping dogs lie or in this case, lying dogs sleep. I think that it's very, very important that justice be done in this case. And I'm sorry, I think that Ben Barnes, since this treason was just now confirmed, ought to be arrested for one single purpose, to debrief this guy on exactly what happened under oath. This is treason. People died. The wrong guy was elected president. This is dangerous stuff. And the idea that, well, it's so long ago. You mean you spent a long time covering it up and you spent all the money that you got. So now everything's fine. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. This should be the beginning of this story, not the end.
I'm right there with you. And as hopefully it continues, love to have you come back.
Well, let me add one thing. If you want to see a film about it, I did it for BBC television. It's called Bush Family Fortunes. It's about the entire Bush family crime wave, which I did for BBC back in 2003. So
and
Bush Family
download
Fortunes,
that for
GregPalace.com.
Yeah. At GregPalace.com. We'll get links out on social media. Greg, as always, great stuff. I'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
You got it. Bye.
Our good friend Greg Palace. Again, remember, make sure you check out his website, GregPalace.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We'll be right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I got to tell you, this, listening to Greg talk about this Ben Barnes, and when you start to think about just how deep this guy was in, the contacts that this guy had, the small incestuous pool, this plays right into, you know, the argument that a lot of my right-wing friends, you know, go on. You can't trust any. They're all criminals because we never hold them accountable. You know, I grew up during the Reagan era. I grew up, you know, my political views during all of the stuff that happened during the Reagan era. All of the attacks on working people. PATCO was the first thing that really stuck in my mind. And it's one of those things where you go, you know, I know we can play this what if game. You know, what if Nixon isn't elected, and we've got Humphrey who continues us down the war on poverty path, and, you know, strengthens labor rights, and, you know, strengthens, you know, working class ethics, and moves us towards being that more perfect union. You know, what happens if Carter's reelected in 1980? Does PATCO happen? Do we create the largest billionaire class in the history of humanity? At the expense of our national debt, do we create, you know, $32 trillion in debt thanks to Reagan? Reagan started that. We were less than $1 trillion in debt when he took office. And again, you know, you look at these crossroads, these moments of decision. And I'm looking at 2024 as another one of those moments in history that, you know, in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, our kids and grandkids are going to look back on and go, did they make the right choice? Did they make the wrong choice? What if, you know, what if you stuck with Biden's policies of reshoring manufacturing? What if you stuck with Biden's policies of taxing the wealthy a little bit and investing in, you know, wanting to end childhood hunger? You know, what if we moved in these directions to make healthcare more accessible and affordable? What if we did these things instead of going the other direction? Which is, well, you know, pay or die healthcare, moving towards, we're going to have choice of education, which means down the road, you're going to have, you know, well-funded private schools that if you're lucky enough to get in, your kids are going to do well, or you're going to be stuck in underfunded, even more underfunded public schools that are just going to warehouse people. Because that's where we're heading. We're in this moment. And I'm unsettled in a whole bunch of different ways. One, you know, the fact that, you know, I don't know in 20 years that we're going to be the constitutionally limited democratic republic that we sit here today kind of like. I don't know that we don't become a fascist nation with an authoritarian president. I can't say that. 10 years ago, with confidence, I could have said, no, that can't happen here. Not us. We're better than that. Even with people we disagree with, we're still better than that. We still agree on democracy. We still agree on the ballot box. I can't say that going forward. And look, the weird thing is, the people I talk to on the right, they can't say it either. It's like we're on the path towards mutually assured destruction. And you know, I talk to people who want to get off, but the trains are coming together. Deregulated trains. Because again, I look at the Republican budget. We're going to cut regulation. We're going to even cut inspections for the trains that we're regulating at the moment. Again, wrong path, wrong policy. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you...
WAUK 540 AM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief video shows a group of sheriff's deputies and employees at a Virginia mental hospital pinning Ivo Otieno to the floor before he suffocated and died. 10 of them are now facing second-degree murder charges. Family attorney Ben Crump.
When black people have mental health issues, many times they're not treated as medical issues. They're treated as criminal issues.
No school tomorrow as workers in the Los Angeles Unified School District enter day two of a three-day strike. CBS's Dee Futterman.
This woman has worked as a special education aide for 17 years.
We need to have a decent, fair wage.
The strike is set to last just 3 days, but union leaders warn there could be other actions if an agreement isn't reached.
At least one person has died in Northern California after wind topples a tree. Problems across the Bay Area and Central Coast, as National Weather Service meteorologist Braden Murdoch explains.
We're still worried about plenty of tree limbs as well as power lines.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
WAUK 540 AM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. More and more Wisconsin school districts are hiring teachers using emergency licenses. A report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum finds that the State Department of Public Instruction issued over 3,000 emergency licenses last year, up from about 1,100 just a decade ago. An emergency license can be issued to people with a bachelor's degree in any subject area. Those teachers don't have to be fully certified. The license can be renewed for those trying to meet the requirements of a full license. A man accused of stealing a van from an Illinois funeral home with a body inside was arrested Sunday in Green Bay after a traffic stop. 23-year-old Dion Howard is facing numerous charges, including possession of a firearm by a felon. The van was stolen in January outside of a Rockford funeral home. The body was later found in Chicago. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Direct from the Dairy State, it's Extra Sharp Weekends, a three-hour block of Wisconsin-produced radio, Saturdays and Sundays from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m., featuring Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman, The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens, and Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown. Enjoy it by the slice or enjoy the whole darn block. Extra Sharp Weekends is radio so fresh, it squeaks. Listen in on the Civic Media Station or on the app.
Heat, power, and water are things people cannot take for granted. The elderly, disabled, the veterans. With record increases in basic costs of living, people are struggling to keep these services on and their bills paid. If you are in danger of losing heat, power, or water, call 1-800-506-5596 or apply online at heat.help. You may not ask for it, but the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help.
Hey, Wisconsin, voting is one of our fundamental rights. Every eligible citizen has the right to be heard. You need an acceptable photo ID to vote in the spring election on April 4th. Vote Riders provides free help. To get your Wisconsin ID card, please visit voteriders.org today. They can answer all your questions about voter ID and offer free help if you need an ID to vote. If you're a citizen and you need an ID, visit voteriders.org. Voteriders.org.
Self-monitor your blood pressure in 4 easy-to-remember steps. Self-monitoring is power. Visit managerbp.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, the American Heart Association, and the American Medical Association, in partnership with the Office of Minority Health and Health Resources and Services Administration.
Society. It would take so little to do so much for so many.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, over the weekend, we talked about this yesterday, we found our way up into New England and stopped by Lawrence, Massachusetts, which was the home of the Bread and Roses strike back in 1912. And we've talked about this. In fact, you've heard a number of our labor history and two that talk about this throughout the year. For me, it was one of those moments where you if you're there, you got to stop because the history just too important, especially in this moment where you've got states like Arkansas, like Iowa, moving on making, well, child labor great again. And, you know, some of the facts and some of the statistics that I grabbed yesterday, the fact that half of the children in the area back in 1912 died before the age of six. 36% of the people who worked in the mill died before they were 25 years old. And that, you know, most of the people who worked there were young girls, you know, 14 to 18 years old. And of course, there were ones that had falsified documents, birth certificates that were made up to make them look 14. You know, Arkansas doing away with permitting kind of strikes for me. So as I was talking about this, I said, you know what? I got to get the expert to walk us through the 1912 Bread and Roses strike and why today it's so important. That's why I've asked Robert Foran to come talk with us. He's a UMass Lowell Distinguished University Professor of Labor History and Immigration Studies. Robert, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So, you know, I'm looking at you know, this moment in history, and I can't help but see similarities today, especially when you're looking at some of the attacks on workers, especially young workers that are going on. This is where my mind went, that there are some similarities. I'm curious if you agree.
I think there are a lot of similarities. The similarities, as you described, with respect to child labor, and it was just news maybe 2 weeks ago of several meatpacking and food processing plants that were using immigrant workers and were depriving them of wages and safe working conditions. And so there's a repetition of what it was like if you were an immigrant worker in the early 20th century. We see something similar with workers trying to organize Amazon warehouses or Starbucks or, you know, Uber drivers or whatever. There's an upsurge in organizing, and there was a similar sort of upsurge in the early 20th century that ultimately leads to things like the Bread and Roses strike. And it's largely immigrant workers who have been neglected by the traditional American labor movement. And so I see similarities that way as well to today. Lots of immigrant workers, female workers, are just not being organized in the late 19th, early 20th century. The American Federation of Labor is doing well, but they're organizing men, skilled workers. They're not organizing sharecroppers. They're not organizing dock workers. And the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, happens on the scene, and they make it a point to say, we'll represent anybody that works for a living. And starting on the West Coast, they sort of work their way east and ultimately are going to end up in Massachusetts, where there are thousands of immigrant mill workers. And so the same, I feel like there's a similar kind of upsurge that's outside the boundary, so to speak, of what we think of as the more traditional labor movement, of people that are trying to organize, you know, Uber drivers or farm workers or immigrant laborers and such, or just they're outside the mainstream of the labor movement. And they're important also, the same as in early 20th century, because they're pushing the establishment labor movement to the left. The establishment labor movement has to somehow, you know, sort of get off its duff, if you will, and start organizing, or they're going to be left behind. And the IWW represents a similar sort of a threat to the establishment labor movement, if you will, back in the early 20th century.
Yeah, now you brought up that the AFL at the time was you know, predominantly organizing skilled workers. You know, in 1912, you know, the industry, the textile industry up there had pretty much done away with the skilled labor that had, in you know, a decade earlier, was making clothing and making the things. And now you've got all of this immigrant labor coming in, exploitable, dividable, and kind of an assembly line system that, you know, doesn't make it as skilled. And, you know, again, I look at, you know, that, and I'm going, you know, today we're seeing kind of the same kind of dynamics that you saw back then with artificial intelligence. You know, there was just a study done a couple of years ago that said, you know, half of the jobs that we currently do will be gone in 10 years, and it's going to be automation doing this, AI doing it, you know, basically de-skilling people. So I'm seeing kind of history repeating itself. Do you see this as well?
Yeah, I mean, we're in the early 20th century. We're sort of in the time of the rise of people like Frederick Taylor and scientific management and Henry Ford's moving assembly line and sort of all the efforts to take away worker control on the shop floor. The more skilled the work was, the more likely it was that workers, if they could organize, would be able to inflict some harm on capital, on management. Big Bill Haywood and others had an expression that the brains of the factory were under the workers' cap. And so if you could create technologies that would take the brain out, and so AI is certainly perfect metaphor for the 21st century, if you could take the knowledge that workers had and encapsulate it in something that didn't take a vacation or need to sleep, you could certainly be far better off. And that was definitely what was happening in the early 20th century in the production of cloth and clothing. The more that you could take it out of the hands of a skilled stitcher or cutter or sewer and embody that in a sewing machine or a piece of machinery or a pattern or whatever it would be, you could then just get lots of fresh new immigrants coming into the country and pit them against each other. The factories in Lawrence were famous for sort of dividing workers by language and putting workers next to each other who didn't speak the same language, which would make it harder for people to talk about their working conditions and supervisors and bad treatment and such. They also paid workers differently. So depending on what immigrant group you were from, and there were about 30 different nationalities represented in Lawrence at the time, everybody was paid differently for doing the same work. And so employer would always sort of say, well, you don't want to be like those Italian workers. They're not making as much money as you. You're a good Lithuanian worker. And as long as they could get over by dividing people, and again, that's a similarity to today, making it harder for people to formulate some more mass organizing strategy, they could keep workers divided, and if they're divided, they're weak.
And whenever I talk about this, Robert, you know, this is one of the things that I focus on, that there are always obstacles in organizing campaigns, and none greater than this when you just brought up 30 different languages that they had to figure out how to overcome to organize people and get everyone on the same page. That's not an easy task because they didn't have cell phones and the apps that translate. They had to do all this stuff by hand and by people power.
Right. And I mean, the thing about the strike that's fascinating in the research that I've done and other people have done, the commitments were made even before the strike actually happened in January of 1912, in the run-up to it as workers were organizing around the city in preparation for a potential of a strike. Commitments were made that meetings would be translated into multiple languages, that anything that was printed, contract language, demands that were being made, whatever it was, everything would be conducted in all the language representing everybody. So basically, because you had such an immigrant flow into the city, you had so many, which really fascinating, you had so many workers that were multilingual. And so you had a worker that spoke Italian, but also lived for a time maybe in France and worked in textiles in France before they emigrated to the United States, and they brought both Italian and French with them. And so if they were in a meeting, they would surround, and somebody was speaking from the front of the room in French, a worker who understood French and Italian would gather all the workers around him or her who spoke Italian and be listening to the French and repeating it in Italian. And so you would have all these little sort of meetings within the meeting around the room of this, you know, just this hubbub of languages being spoken so that people could understand each other. And they would even do this outdoors. So the strike is taking place in the middle of the winter, and the biggest meetings had to be held on the Lawrence Common because there wasn't any place big enough to hold thousands of workers. And they would do this outside in the snow and the rain and the ice, and take the time, right? A meeting's going to take that much longer if I'm talking, but now I wait because I have to make sure somebody else can translate for everybody. It takes longer to do that, and if you're freezing outside, but that was the commitment, and people stuck to it.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible thing. So when I hear people complaining about it's so hard to organize today, and it is. Look, our labor laws are broken. It is difficult. The employer holds a lot of the cards. The pendulum has swung. But I go back to this moment, and I go back to this strike and go, look, yeah, they endured much greater obstacles and were able to overcome. So there is a possibility to win these things.
Yeah, and again, they don't have the means of communication that we would have today in terms of cell phones and text messaging and, you know, instant messaging and Twitter and whatever else, people, TikTok, whatever, stuff that my students understand that I don't want to ever learn about. but they were able to. I mean, the other thing that's fascinating about the strike is the research that people have done. One of the things that survived the strike are all these arrest records of people that were arrested during the strike. And one of the things you see when you go through the arrest records is lots of people who are immigrants from different places in the world are all living, and this is a revelation to historians, are not necessarily, some of them are, but a lot of them aren't necessarily living in immigrant neighborhoods that are strictly French-speaking or Italian-speaking or Polish-speaking. They're living in these tenement blocks where multiple languages are spoken. And we know this because people get arrested. And when you look at it, it's on the same day at the same time, a dozen women get arrested. And when you look at their address, they all live in the same tenement block. So it's clear to us in looking at that, that they formed an affinity group and they went out to raise hell. And they ended up getting arrested, but they knew each other. They trusted each other. They had the commonalities of their work experience of trying to struggle to raise kids. And all of that made their ability to overcome a language difference that much easier and that much more important to do because they shared such common experiences. And you see this all over the strike. I mean, women lead the strike in a sense of the confrontations with the police, with state security that's brought in to try to crush the strike. And they're getting arrested together. There's a district attorney who talks about women. There's a quote in one of the newspapers that we found that it takes one policeman to arrest four men and it takes four policemen to arrest one woman. It's just like apt for the strike and for the militancy and the passion with which the women engaged in the strike. And again, their ability to overcome their language differences and barriers because of these other commonalities that they had. And again, that they ventured out together in solidarity with one another to embark upon whatever the crazy day was in Lawrence during the strike.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Robert Forrant. He's a distinguished university professor of labor history and immigration studies at UMass Lowell. We're talking about the Bread and Roses strike from 1912. That name, I know, but explain to people why. How did it get the name? Why is that name important? And what can we grab from that today?
Yeah, so it's fascinating because there's no evidence that we've ever been able to find that during the strike anybody ever sort of used that expression or that there was a sign or whatever. There was a labor poet, a worker poet who wrote poetry a lot before the strike even happened. A guy by the name of Robert Oppenheim, and he wrote this poem called Bread and Roses, but he wrote it before the strike even happened. He wrote it in 1911, and he reissued it after the strike happened and said he wrote it about the strike, but it was clearly published in 1911. And so it sat, but then in the 1970s, Mimi Farina and other folk singers and musicians, but I think she was the main person, put the poem to music. And turned Bread and Roses into what became the sort of national anthem of the strike. And there was a move in the 1970s, amongst other things, happened in higher ed to teach labor studies, women's history, and people were looking for these examples that could be utilized, you know, as focal points for rallying to get this history taught. And the poem turned into music, became an anthem in a way for the women's movement. And for particularly like the hospital workers organizing in New York City, Hospital Workers Union 1199 had a cultural educational arm of the union, basically called Bread and Roses. And they created a lot of imagery that went with it. and a lot of it sort of came out of that. Then this significant painter, Ralph Fasanella, who was from New York City, started painting what are now quite famous gigantic mural pieces of the history of the strike. He came to Lawrence and sat on the canals gazing at the mill buildings and sort of created these incredible pieces of art. People have seen them around as posters. You might not know it's Ralph Fasanella when you see it, but anybody, you know, involved in labor history at all is going to say, oh yeah, that's what, if they see it, they're going to know it. That's Ralph Fasanella. And then the Village Voice actually sent some reporters to Lawrence, and they started writing, resurrecting history. And sort of out of that came this new, renewed interest in the history of the strike, celebrating the strike. And I think it sort of, things began to take off from there. But initially at the 50th anniversary of the strike in the 1960s, we're in the midst of the Cold War. The city of Lawrence doesn't want to commemorate the strike. They commemorate an aspect of the strike, which was the religious church backlash to the strike, something called the God and Country Parade that was held in 1912. And instead of having a commemoration to the strike, they had a commemoration to the God and Country Parade and did it up in true Cold War America fashion, with missiles and tanks and parading soldiers. And the history of the strike just disappeared for a really long time. It went underground for generations.
But the idea of bread and roses, the idea of, you know, your labor should get you at least basic, you know, basic needs, but also something a little bit better.
Yes. Yep.
That's an anthem and a battle cry that I think workers today can grab onto, that your labor should get you, you know, at least a reasonable standard of living, and then, you know, some decent things along the way as well.
Yeah, you shouldn't be living paycheck to paycheck. If you're working your butt off, you shouldn't be faced every other week with economic insecurity, because until you get paid, you can't buy groceries. That's too often the case. And in 1912, I mean, the precipitator of the strike was there had been lots and lots of organizing around the country and in Massachusetts too, to shorten the work week, to create a legal shorter work week. And the average work week for factory workers, mill workers in Lawrence, and one of the reasons people were working themselves to death, some of the statistics that you mentioned at the beginning, people working 56 hours a week and they were barely making a living. And so the Massachusetts legal work week was going to be cut all of 2 hours to 54, starting in January of 1912. This was seen as progressive reform in America in the early 20th century, to go from 56 to 54 hours a week. And the workers were worried that if it went from 56 to 54, their wages would be cut. And they already couldn't make ends meet. And so if they lost 2 hours pay, it's a weird sort of thing, where on the one hand, it's seen by some people as a reform, but by workers, it's seen as a threat to their standard, a really serious threat to their standard of living. It might not seem much to us in looking back on it, but it was the marginal difference in people having food. And so workers tried in 1911 throughout most of the year to meet with mill owners and say, are you going to cut our wages, or are we going to, you know, are we going to work 54 hours but for 56 hours pay? And the mill owners wouldn't tell them what they were going to do. And so the workers surmised, well, if it was good news, they'd tell us. So obviously they're going to cut our pay. And so if they cut our pay, we're going to walk off the job. And so they're quietly organizing in 1911, the latter half of 1911, into these language affinity groups and things that we were speaking about a few minutes ago. And basically it's sort of like a what-if scenario. When the first workers get paid in 1912, if they're paid short, they will walk out and everybody else, when they get paid, will follow. And so the first workers get paid actually on January 11th in Lawrence. They're Polish women in one of the factories in Lawrence, and they see their pay and it's short, and they walk out and they parade around the mills, a pretty compact area in the downtown of Lawrence, yelling up to the windows of all the mills, short pay all out, short pay all out. They're yelling it in Polish, and I don't know how to say that in Polish, so I'm not even going to try.
And it's amazing that everyone did come, and it's that kind of, It's that kind of story that I think is important, and I hope people will learn for it from it. But Robert, I appreciate the time. I look forward to having you come back and share some more such fascinating history that I think we don't know enough about. So I'd love to have you come back and share some more
thoughts. Sure, anytime. You know how to find me.
Outstanding stuff. Thank you so much. Robert Forent, Distinguished University Professor of Labor History and Immigration Studies there at UMass Lowell. I got to take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up. Stick around. You'll listen to the Rick Smith Show. For working people, I've been talking. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1857. Labor activist Alice Henry was born in Melbourne, Australia. Alice originally went to work as a teacher, but then found her true calling as a journalist. She wrote in support of the day's progressive causes, including care for dependent children, labor reform, and women's rights. Her writings and speeches garnered attention well outside of Australia. And in 1905, she was invited to work for the National Women's Trade Union League of America. The WTUL was an important U.S. women's labor organization, supporting several strikes and advocating for women's suffrage. The League tried to bridge the tensions that often existed between middle-class progressive reformers and working-class women. The League also attempted to build ties with the American Federation of Labor, pushing for the AFL to do more for women workers. Unfortunately, these efforts often went ignored. Alice joined the League office in Chicago, where she again put her pen to work for the causes of women's suffrage and the rights of working people. For 8 years, Alice served as the editor of the women's page of the popular labor paper, The Union Labor Advocate. She served as a lecturer and as a field organizer. Alice advocated that when possible, women form their own unions. She believed that the independent locals would allow women a greater voice than in the male-dominated union movement of the day. In a 1915 essay, she wrote, "The meetings of women and girls only draw better attendances, give far more opportunity for all the members to take part in the business, and, beyond all question, form the finest training ground for the women leaders who, in considerable numbers, are needed so badly in the women's side of the trade union movement today." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I got to tell you, you know, in listening to Robert, which I could talk to him for hours, a fascinating guy, and this era, you know, fascinating. The fact that you could overcome 30 different languages and get people on the same page. Imagine that. Imagine for a moment getting 30 different languages, different ideologies, different life experiences, everybody on the same page. Everybody coming together and saying, you know, we're going to fight for a common goal. Better wages, hours, conditions, respect on the job. And I guess, you know, starvation will do that to you. Because they worked for starvation wages. And they were literally dying before each other's eyes. Brown lung was prevalent. And as I said, you know, when half of the children die before age 6, you got a problem. When 36% of the people who work in the mill die before age of 25, wow, you got a problem. And you wonder where safety regulations come from. You wonder where all this stuff comes from. It comes from horrible tragedy. Robert did hit on something interesting, because one of the conversations we're going to begin having over the next several weeks and months is the idea of, you know, how do we lessen the work week? There's a push for a 4-day work week. The conversation that's not being had with that is, those 4 days going to be paid at 5 days' wages? Are people going to be able to make ends meet? And the reason I thought it was interesting to bring Robert on is a lot of the same dynamics of that strike in 1912 are going to be playing out before us right now. Mechanization, you know, automation's coming, shorter work weeks, all of the things that, and look, you know, the fact that employers have an upper hand because labor is not as strong as they should be, because they've done a great job. Corporate America has done a great job of dividing us. And maybe we don't have the kind of language barriers that they overcame in 1912, but we've got barriers. The question is, how do we put those down? How do we come together and find that common ground to help each other move forward? If you've got thoughts, I want to hear it. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Appreciate you tuning in. Look forward to being back here next time. Thanks for being here.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.